Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has spent a lot of his life in the intelligence business is the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. He is our colleague there and a very important contributor to this program and now also to our new television program, Securing America. His name is Fred Flights. He's worked at the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, the House Intelligence Committee, and the National Security Council under Donald Trump, and we are always privileged to have a chance to visit with him. Fred, welcome back. You've published recently, Fred, an analysis of a country that you followed very closely in the course of your career going back to the agency, namely North Korea. In a peculiar midnight parade that Kim Jong-un oversaw, they wheeled through Pyongyang on an 11-axle monster mobile transport erector launcher, what appears to be a new intercontinental range ballistic missile. Tell us what you make of this. Is it real or is it Memorex, if you can say, and what it would portend if it is real?
Frank, it's good to be here. Well, this parade was interesting. It was the first parade since February of 2018 where the North Koreans displayed missiles. They've actually played down their missile program for 2 years because of President Trump's policy in North Korea. It's not that they've stopped developing them, but they have stopped testing them. They've stopped displaying them. And what we saw here was the largest mobile ICBM ever made. That isn't to say there's larger ICBMs, but there isn't one that's so large that is mobile. And it was larger than the last one that North Korea tested, the Hwasong-15, which was tested in November 2017. Now, many experts set off alarm bells when they saw this. They said, this is a monster missile. It'll be a real threat to the next president. And that's possible. I'm a little skeptical, and I have some other experts who believe this because the missile hasn't been tested. Some experts are saying that this is a missile that could carry a very heavy warhead that could hit the entire continental United States. I think that is true, however, or could carry MIRVs. However, North Korea has not mastered the art of reentry vehicles, which is crucial for a warhead to reenter the atmosphere and strike its target, and has not even tested MIRVs. So I think this is alarming, but we don't know that this missile is anywhere near ready to be deployed. And also, Frank, we know the North Koreans have a history of displaying mock-ups, fake missiles. So there's a lot that we don't know. What I think we can say with certainty is that this missile was displayed to affect the foreign policy of the next president, either to pressure Donald Trump to come up with a deal with concessions in North Korea, something I think will fail. But far more likely is that the North Koreans are preparing for what they believe will be extremely weak Korea policies of a Biden administration, and they're waiting for concessions.
Fred, let me ask you a question related to Kim Jong-un that goes to some extent what he's up to, yes, but also his condition and, more to the point, kind of the status of his hold on power. He addressed an audience in North Korea recently and was openly weeping as he was describing his own shortcomings and failures on behalf of the people of North Korea. Those are, of course, manifest to most of us, but not, generally speaking, the sort of thing that totalitarian thugs ever acknowledge, let alone do so with shows of emotion like that. What did you make of all of that? And does it speak to his health as well as perhaps his hold on power?
Well, it's funny, Frank. I often do interviews with people and remark that it looks like Kim Jong-un has been reported to be dead once again. I watched North Korean television tape repeatedly to check out images of this missile. He looked healthy to me, but I do admit his behavior seemed a little bit odd. The Kim family has always behaved odd. I don't know what that means exactly, but there are things about the dynamics of the Kim regime and the Kim power structure that outsiders just don't know. I know that people close to Kim have said that there are factors on him that influence or limit his ability to make decision making. And whether that's true, no one is sure who that is. So, I don't know who observed what you just said. I don't doubt that it's true, but I don't have an answer for it.
I'm going through mostly a thought experiment here, whether, if you are a thug and you have ruled with the utmost brutality, including killing your own uncle with, as I recall, an anti-aircraft gun, which is a pretty brutal thing, you don't generally survive if you show anything remotely like weakness. Well, that's right, a chemical weapon on his half-brother. Exactly right. So it's an interesting thing. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, Fred. Let me turn to one other thing quickly before we have to let you go, and that is your current reading on what's been declassified of late about, what might be called the anti-Trump conspiracy. In National Review, you had a piece saying, well, it's helpful, but it may have come too late. Talk about that, if you would, Fred.
Well, we know D&I Radcliffe, the director of national intelligence, has been releasing documents at the president's direction on the Russia collusion hoax and Hillary Clinton's email server scandal. But I'm just really upset that he gave most of these documents to the Justice Department. He didn't actually release them. And I'm happy things are being released now. We're actually learning things you should have learned years ago. But I'm afraid that this collusion hoax is baked into the American people. They're numb to it now. I don't think new disclosures are going to affect them very much. I wish this had come out at least 6 months ago.
Speaking of what's just come out, Fred, what have you made about the revelations about Hunter Biden's various dealings with foreign powers while his father was the vice president of the United States? Have you had a chance to look at the reporting on that?
I have, and it looks pretty damaging to Biden. I think just as appalling is how there is a media blackout of this information. And it's just clear that the major media outlets are in the tank to get Biden elected. They'll print anything negative to President Trump, and they're doing everything possible to cover for Biden.
And it's, of course, not just the mainstream, as they call themselves, media. It's the social media, which have now gone into full censorship mode. I've never seen anything like it. I never thought I would see anything like it in our country, I have to say, Fred. And I don't know whether it will work. I don't know whether the other means of communication, including this program, with your help, will enable the American people to be kept apprised of the sorts of things they need to make informed decisions. But it's really scandalous, and it's entirely inconsistent with the freedoms that we have long taken for granted, unfortunately, and that we will rue allowing to slip from our grasp if we do. Fred, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for getting us started today, as always, for your leadership at the Center for Security Policy and your lifetime of service to our country, which continues now in this important new role. God bless you. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with Derek Maltz, a former Drug Enforcement Agency senior official, about the drug war and how we're doing in it, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a special privilege as well as distinct pleasure to say a welcome to Derek Maltz. He is a former longtime official in the Drug Enforcement Agency. Indeed, he served some 28 years in that role, concluding his service as the special agent in charge of the U.S. Department of Justice Special Operations Division. He also served formerly as the chief of the New York Drug Enforcement Task Force, and is currently the Director of Government Relations for PennLink Limited. Suffice it to say, Derek Maltz knows his way around the drug business and has done his fair share of trying to help protect the rest of us from it. It's a great delight to have you with us, Derek. Thank you very much for taking the time to chat a little bit. we happen to have a pretty important news peg. There was a tremendous bust by your old outfit yesterday. Tell us about it, what went down out in L.A., and what have we been spared as a result?
Well, Frank, first of all, the cartels have completely dominated the drug distribution all over America. We're talking about poisonous drugs like fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, and even marijuana. But what we had yesterday was the head of the DEA reported a record seizure of 2,200 pounds of meth being seized in L.A. But this is part of an ongoing effort they called Operation Crystal Shield, which has yielded tremendous results. They're targeting the hub cities in America that are involved with the distribution of meth. You see, Frank, a lot of people are not reporting on meth. They're reporting on the opioid crisis because it's killing people. But so is methamphetamine. This is very pure methamphetamine. And just on a side note, last week down on the border, CBP and DEA and Homeland Security reported the seizure of 3,000 pounds of methamphetamine. And so we have a very, very large-scale public health and public national security emergency in this country because of the drugs being flooded into our country. But the big thing that's missing, Frank, is the connection to China.
That's what I wanted to go to next, Derek. But before we do, just quickly, how much of methamphetamine production is actually inside the United States as opposed to coming in through the cartel's various networks?
Great question, Frank. So let me give you a brief explanation on that. So years ago, there were a lot of meth labs all over America, right? Mostly in the Midwest and then the West Coast of America. And it was mostly like small-time production. We like to refer to them as mom-and-pop labs, right? They were bringing in their precursor chemicals right here into America. But then the DEA started a very aggressive program keeping, you know, better regulations and restrictions on the precursor chemicals like pseudoephedrine and ephedrine, which are key ingredients to make meth. So the cartels took advantage of this like they always do because it's about making money. They started building super labs, industrial-sized production centers in Mexico. Basically, the Sinaloa cartel and now the Jalisco New Generation cartel have major production labs where they import massive ton quantities of chemicals from China and other countries in Asia, and they produce their own meth. So there's still labs in America, don't get me wrong, but the majority of the meth, that 90%, 95% of the meth is coming right over that southwest border from these labs. Now, I'll give you one quick anecdotal story. My buddies from the DEA went down to Mexico last summer. They went to a lab site that was producing 7 tons of methamphetamine every 3 days. Just to give you an idea.
I trust they were there for not just an inspection, but to shut the place down, were they not?
Well, it was already shut down by the Mexican officials with the DEA down there in country, but they were just kind of showing the DEA the magnitude of what we're talking about today. And a lot of people are missing that.
Yeah, Derek, and on that point, how aggressively is the government of Mexico actually taking these factories offline?
Well, Frank, the governor of Mexico is loaded with corruption from the bottom to the top. And that's been well reported, well publicized. It's very political, a whole story about Mexico being on the southwest border. But what the American people need to understand is what a national security threat this is. I mean, we had over 70,000 people die from overdoses of drugs last year. The vast majority of the overdoses are coming from synthetic opioids, which is the fentanyl that's coming from China and Mexico, right? So we have tremendous amount of families suffering and people that are dying because of these chemicals that are being dropped into our country. So we have a serious problem right at our border, and the Mexican government is not doing enough. It's that simple.
I want to come to China in just a second, but lastly on this point, Derek, you've obviously operated in these areas personally and know them well. What techniques are the cartels using to get those drugs across that border, and how well equipped are our teams to contend with those techniques?
So they are super equipped. As you know, they have very sophisticated tunnels. There's been several tunnels seized. There's a San Diego task force with all the agencies. They've done a tremendous job. They have good sources. They've identified and dismantled the tunnels. But they're using, you know, automobiles every day. They're using people that run across the border. They're using, you know, drones, right? They have drones coming into the country. They're using, like, you know, trains and these They use boats, obviously. They go into the ports in California. They will do anything they have to do to get the drugs into the country. They have very sophisticated concealed compartments in vehicles where you can't really detect these drugs in these compartments unless you have x-rays or you have sources. But it's impossible for our Border Patrol to go ahead and inspect every single vehicle, every single tractor trailer. I mean, they come in these large tractor trailers with legitimate produce, legitimate products from Mexico and Central America. So it's very overwhelming for the Border Patrol. It's very overwhelming for the law enforcement agencies. They do pretty good, but there's just so much demand. And that's another issue that we have to talk about when we talk about the drug crisis.
The firepower of these folks is another factor that maybe we can come back to with you on another occasion, but because I know that's making this vastly more dangerous and difficult a task for the interception and prevention of these operations. But let's turn to China and what it's doing. You talked about precursor chemicals coming from China. Fentanyl is also coming, as I understand it, from China. Some of it's just being mailed into this country, I'm told. But what is the role that the Chinese are playing in this? And do you see this as basically kind of a twofer for them? One, it obviously is a money-making scheme, but also it's a kind of payback for the opium wars against the West?
Frank, I see this as communist China looks at us as a major adversary, and through their communist unrestricted warfare policies, they're going to use all available options at their disposal to hurt America. And that's what they're doing. They're dropping the poison in our country. They're involved with all aspects of the drug crisis here. Besides the fact that they're dumping the fentanyl into Mexico, they're sending it in the mail. People are buying it over the internet. They also are providing the vast majority of the precursor chemicals that are producing all the meth, which is destroying families and communities all over the country. They're involved with large-scale indoor grow operations, marijuana grow operations. They buy real estate all over the West Coast. They set up these indoor grow operations in neighborhoods where people are trying to bring up their kids and their families. And then they're selling this very, very pure marijuana all around the country. They sell the drug paraphernalia. But here's the thing, Frank, that they really have been starting to dominate, and that is the money laundering services for all the cartels' business. They have sophisticated schemes, trade-based money laundering. They bring millions and millions of dollars through the casinos in Las Vegas. They have so many sophisticated methods to launder the money, but this keeps the cartels in business. Without the money and without the chemicals, you don't have a business, right? And so China is playing an intricate role. I've said it on national news. I will say it again. I believe it's like it's a weapon of mass destruction to send this poison into our country to watch our families being destroyed and our kids dying all over the place at record levels.
It must be just heartbreaking to a professional like yourself who spent so much time trying to protect us against these scourges that they're still getting away with it. And I'm so glad you brought up this point, though, Derek, about unrestricted warfare. We talk about it on this program all of the time, but this angle of attack has to be seen as an act of war against us as well. I think you're absolutely right about that.
So, Frank, when we arrested Afghanis, you know what they used to tell us? That selling heroin to the West is a jihad against the West. Well, this is the same type of thing with China. They are doing it under the radar, and they're getting away with it.
Derek, let me just take advantage of your expertise, because you've touched on it twice now. We, of course, are in the midst of a, I think, insane rising crescendo of legislation across this country to legalize marijuana. And what you particularly are referring to, of course, is a very, very high-grade marijuana, which, as I understand it, is not your 1960 hippies version of the stuff. But talk a little bit about it as both an entry-level drug to worse, but it's a danger in its own right.
Well, look, again, you just hit it perfectly. You said it perfectly. The people in Congress are so out of touch with reality, they're thinking about the joints that most of them smoked back in the 60s and the 70s, where, what is it, 4 or 5% THC? Now, when you talk to the experts, they'll tell you the high, pure THC content that's impacting the brains of people all over the country every single day. This is not a harmless drug. This is a very dangerous drug that we have kind of just like you know, left it alone as far as the public attention. I mean, many states, as you know, it's legal, right? So it creates a problem even for law enforcement. You have task force operations where the state and local police can't even go out on the raids if there's marijuana involved. Meanwhile, it's global Chinese Mexican cartel organizations at most of these times, right, Frank? So it's a very dangerous situation, and I blame the administration, you know, many years ago. I blame the Obama administration. They glamorized the marijuana, that it was okay, no big deal. Everyone used marijuana.
And now it's a big jobs program, of course, for underprivileged communities, isn't it? So there's all kinds of scams going on here. But Derek Maltz, I have to leave it at that for the moment. But we're going to have you back, I hope, often. I know you'll be on our television program, Securing America, at 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And we look forward to talking with you there. Thanks for your time today. Keep up the good work you're now doing. And thank you for your continuing service to our country. Next up, we'll speak with Jeff Nyquist a bit more about that China unrestricted warfare business and a lot more besides. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And I always am delighted to be able to say welcome back to Jeff Nyquist, a regular contributor now, I'm pleased to say, both to this program and to Securing America, our new television program at americasvoice.news. Jeff Nyquist is the author most recently of The Fool and His Enemy, and you can find his writings, among other places, at jrnyquist.blog. Jeff, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Let me ask you, Jeff, about something you posted on that blog site recently, an interview that Vladimir Putin had, which was an extraordinary, it seems, moment of candor for a very cagey guy. Or was it a moment of caginess by a not very frequently candid folk? What do you make of what he said and what it means?
Well, it's a fascinating question. Yes, they lie. That is, Russian leaders or politicians, but it's not exactly always just what you think it is, because they're always signaling to their troops. They're always signaling what they really think. Anne Navarre, the famous French journalist who went into the Second Chechen War dressed as a Chechen peasant, who famously interviewed the president of Chechnya and then was arrested and fetched out by the FSB out of Chechnya to be deported to France, had this conversation with these two KGB officers, FSB officers, but really they saw themselves as still being part of the old KGB. And they discussed with her Putin, the new at that time president of Russia, and they said, we know he's part of the old system. He knows he's one of our guys, they told her. We just wish he would come out and say so. And if you've studied Putin's statements over the years, he has had these very poignant moments where he has come out and said so. And people in the West, mainly just experts, because it's not noticed by the public or by journalists generally, have momentarily had moments of fright over it. What does it mean? With the Beslan massacre, he basically made a speech, and this was 2003, I think, late summer, in which he declared war on the United States. He appeared to do that, but it was in coded language, saying that we had basically attacked them, that it would be as if the U.S. president had said that Russia was behind 9/11. Then, of course, at other times, he made statements similar to the ones he made the other day, in which he said he never destroyed his party card. He believed in communist ideas. There was nothing wrong with him. And then he would compare those ideas to Christianity, which he did here. So these things are, and they're sort of what I would call them, signaling the troops, hey, I'm still with you. This is still a communist project. I remember I had a conversation with Colonel Stanislav Lunev, the GRU defector, after Putin came to power. And actually, I had it on the set of a television program in which we were both participating in Texas. And I said, well, you know, and Lunev was a Leningrader. He was from St. Petersburg, like like Putin. And he said, well, he's a communist. And I said, well, really, how do you know? And he says, well, I know. That is what he really is. And that quite astonished me. But I have in my following him, really, it is true. If you talk to Russian nationalists, they are persecuted. Actual real Russian nationalists are persecuted. In fact, some of them famously, they're exiled to Poland or the Baltic states. And because Putin's pretense at being a Christian and a nationalist is just that. It's a deception game. He really isn't. And that is very confusing to people in the West and many conservatives who regard him as a nationalist and a Christian.
And that really brings me to the question of the moment. He is still imbued with a lot of this communist ideology that's obviously atheistic as well as totalitarian in character. So what did he say about the Democrats in that regard, particularly the Soviet period Democrats?
Yes, in the interview, he basically compared the American Democratic Party to the Communist Party Soviet Union. So he basically said that they were had the same roots in European social democracy and their ideas. So he said they're similar, and therefore he could work with Biden because they shared a common ideological set of ideals or ideas. This is an extraordinary thing to say because it's as if he's not just signaling the troops now in Russia, but he's signaling the troops in America. And it's almost as if he's signaling them that he's not their enemy anymore.
Well, he's arguably not been the enemy of the Democrats in this country, certainly the Marxists among them. And I don't mean to say all Democrats are now, let alone that they have always been. I myself was one when I worked for Scoop Jackson, the anti-communist Democrat of the first order. But Jeff, I guess what I'm hearing you say is that a thoughtful reading of what Putin was communicating in this interview the other day was that he's far from, you know, throwing in with Donald Trump to make sure that he's getting reelected. He's perfectly content, if not thrilled at the prospect of working with Joe Biden. Is that overstating proposition?
No, it's not. And, you know, they said this about Stalin. And of course, Putin is a kind of a disciple of Stalin and has praised Stalin. And the revival of the cult of Stalin has happened under Putin in Russia. It's that Stalin's great political achievement was that he could ride a horse in both directions, which means he could take opposite political positions and somehow make it work. For example, the Hitler-Stalin Pact, after being opposed to Hitler, how could he do this? Stalin did this. Putin is doing this. And see, everybody in the Democratic Party thinks that Putin put Trump, well, the whole narrative of the Democratic Party has been that ever since Hillary Clinton said it 4 years ago, Trump is Putin's puppet, right? And so, therefore, this idea that Putin is a nationalist and he's a bad guy and he's opposed to the ideals of the American Democratic Party, now he's saying he could have said these things 4 years ago, but he's saying them now. Which I think the timing of it is significant. He's saying, look, I'm not necessarily a supporter of Mr. Trump, my ideas are really closer to yours. But he said it in such a cagey way. And when he praised Trump as being someone he could work with as well in the same interview, he then listed all the things Trump had done against him, which is also quite fascinating.
And again, perhaps truthful as far as it goes, both for the consumption of his friends here as well as there, needless to say. So this brings us to the sort of question du jour, and that is Hillary Clinton evidently manufactured the anti-Trump conspiracy using this theme that there's collusion between him, or at least his campaign, and the Russians. It turns out, we now know, Jeff Nyquist, that she actually was doing just that, in part for the purpose of trying to prevent him from winning the election. Putin was presumably apprised of all of that. And I'm also very much of the view that it's important to keep in mind that what Hillary was doing for Putin in her time, notably as Secretary of State, whether it was the Uranium One deal or this, even more, as far as I'm concerned, notorious Skolkovo operation, which involved helping the Russians build a Silicon Valley of their own with access to all kinds of dual-use technology from the United States, from which, it seems, a number of Clinton Foundation contributors benefited handsomely. But the country suffered much. So knowing what you do about Putin and what, you know, his strategic acumen is and his ability, as you say, to ride the horse in both directions, leaves us where, Jeff? Is there any doubt in your mind that that he has a preferred candidate in this race? And what would his policy look like towards, let's just say for purpose of discussion, a Biden presidency
or one to emerge? There's no doubt that he was for Hillary Clinton, and he's for Biden, and here's why. One of the big things for Russia is that the U.S. not revive its nuclear weapons manufacturing capability, and in the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton stated that she would kill that program to procure new nuclear weapons for the United States. I mean, that's so basic to their whole approach to everything. There's no way he wasn't just drooling to have her be president. And the same thing with Biden. And recently Hillary Clinton, who is of course a supporter of Biden and a very important person in the Democratic Party, said that the United States should cut back on its production of tanks and airplanes, you know, so that we could have more money to spend here domestically. The Democrats will strip defenses further. And this is something that the Russians want, because what do they want? More of a free hand in Europe. They want America to withdraw from Europe. They want to be the country that's going to dominate Europe.
And I've long felt that it's all about sort of a redo, as far as Putin is concerned, to restore not only the greatness of Russia, but also to undo the humiliation of defeat at the hands of the United States and the West, notably at Ronald Reagan's great victory. Jeff, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment at least, but we'll be talking with you again next week, I know. And thank you for your time today, as well as your continuing support for these efforts to educate our public about the choices we have to make very soon and very, very momentously. Thank you, my friend. It's good to talk with you. Next up, we will speak with Anders Kaur about what we need to do about China as well. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Dr. Anders Kaur. Anders is an author and very accomplished and internationally recognized expert on the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it poses to us. Anders is the principal at Kaur Analytics and publisher of the Journal of Political Risk. He is the editor, most recently, of Great Powers, Grand Strategy, The New Game in the South China Sea. Let me also say he is an important member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, which I have the privilege of vice chairing, and I'm always appreciative of your efforts in that domain as well. Let's talk quickly, if we can, about something that I sort of got into with Derek Maltz a short while ago, and that is the unrestricted warfare that the Chinese Communist Party has now been waging against this country for decades. And he spoke to it specifically from the perspective of a distinguished former Drug Enforcement Agency leader in the sort of use of narcotics to kill Americans and make money as one of the lines of attack. But how would you characterize, Anders, more generally, what the Chinese Communist Party is up to that animates this unrestricted warfare, if you will, against us?
Well, I think that, I mean, the tens of thousands of Americans who are killed every year by opioids and, you know, $200 to $600 billion of IP theft every year from China. And you start to see that, you know, China's expansionism has very real consequences for your average American. And it's not even clearly understood by most of us exactly how deep that is and how pervasive that is. And then you add on COVID-19 to the top of that. And it's almost an all-out assault on America, what America stands for in terms of freedom, democracy, the republic, human rights. And it, to me, it is something that we're absolutely need to be incredibly serious about. And unfortunately, we're not seeing the level of intensity that we need. The Trump administration has done a lot in the last couple of years to ramp up the attention on China and to ramp up the response on China. And so that is, I mean, it's been a game changer. Trump has broken the mold on how to deal with China. And he did it from the very first day when he called Taiwan right off the bat. But even so, we need a much tougher response to China. And the fact that the U.S. is now, the polling is saying that Biden is going to win should really be a wake-up call, a second and a third wake-up call to us that the U.S. is in very dire straits right now with how we're not effectively responding to the China challenge.
Let's talk about the choice that Americans are facing. Just, if you would, Anders, sort of tease out how a U.S. policy towards a clearly hostile and increasingly aggressive communist China looks like, based on at least past policy preferences and positions of the vice president and before that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman.
Well, I mean, I think one thing that recently happened, was the South Korean ambassador who said, "Oh, well, South Korea doesn't need to be allies with the United States. We could." We need to consider being allies with China as well. We can do that. And maybe he was doing this to get a negotiating edge over how much defense expenditures, South Korea contributes or how much they contribute to U.S. defense expenditures. But, you know, for him to even say that, I think should get our attention. And in my opinion, you know, our response to that should be, you know, we have certain values, and those values include, you know, not supporting the fascism and totalitarianism that we see in China. And if you have a South Korean ambassador who doesn't at least understand that basic principle, that ambassador is going home on the next flight. We don't want him in the U.S. We're sending him back, and we're going to create an international incident with South Korea to make our point that we just simply cannot accept that line of thinking. You know, so that's the kind of immediate and tough response that I think we need. And I'm not seeing us do it. I'm not seeing us do what we need to do to be tough enough on China. And then the other, China just got elected onto the UN Human Rights Commission. Another case of just outrageous, flagrant, destruction of what the UN in 1945 was founded to do, one of which was uphold human rights and take a stand against genocide. And now we have China, which is a genocidal nation, joining the UN Human Rights Committee. And it's made a mockery of everything we fought for in World War II. So, you know, we just have to take a much more serious stance.
So the problem is that that seems unlikely to be the direction that Biden-Harris, let's say, administration would take. Were Donald Trump to be reelected, given what we've seen of his policies to date, I'm hearing from lots of people that he would really be unshackled to the extent that he has been by this election and be even more vigorous and robust towards China. Do you credit that, Anders?
I believe that. I mean, if you look at what Pompeo is doing and what Peter Navarro has done, you know, they have really taken a stand on China to an extent that no, you know, administration prior to Nixon has done. And it's incredible what they've done. And, you know, now you see Betsy DeVos just released a letter yesterday about the Confucius Institutes, along with Pompeo. And they were really good letters that you know, that basically called out the Confucius Institute. Pompeo also sent out a letter about think tanks saying, hey, if, you know, we need to know if you're funded from foreign sources, you need to put that in a prominent place on your website. You know, it should be a no-brainer, but it hasn't been.
It hasn't been, and we've seen lots of these think tanks, and, you know, I've worked in one for most of my professional life, that have gotten away with taking money and having their, you know, recommendations, analyses, and so on, very clearly influenced by who they take money from, including foreign sources. So I'm for a full disclosure on that score for sure. So Anders, you know, either way, it seems to me, we're going to find this problem of China being job one for the next commander in chief. You've expressed, I think, helpfully, the likely differences between the approach, but I think it's sufficient to say for this purpose that we need a mandate from the American people for this threat to be dealt with robustly by, again, whoever takes on the job of president in 2021.
Yeah, if Biden wins, you know, the mandate is going to be, let's calm down, let's not, you know, poke the tiger as much as we have been. And you know, that this is what Biden is saying. He wants to engage China. Harris is saying that, you know, he wants to go back to this failed strategy of engagement, which is just kicking the can down the road. It's appeasement. And it's going to get us in a worse situation 4 years from now than we are today.
And we can't afford it to get worse. It's, I guess, the bottom line of all of this, isn't it? And whether the mandate is correct or incorrect or misperceived, we'll just have to see. But thank you for helping illuminate the choice and what we all should be thinking very seriously about as we make it this election season. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you again soon, and I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.